This is Dissecting Dragons, a speculative fiction podcast for writers and readers by writers and readers.
Hello, and welcome to Dissecting Dragons, the speculative fiction podcast for writers and readers by writers and readers. I'm Madeleine Vaughan.
And I'm Jules Ironside. This week, winter is here. End of Thrones.
So, in case anyone hasn't figured out by the title, this episode is all about Game of Thrones.
Yes, predominantly the series, and we're starting with the last episode. So, big spoiler alert, if you haven't seen it yet and you somehow managed to avoid spoilers, turn this off and go and watch it before you listen to this.
Because, yeah, we're going to be discussing the final season in general, but, yeah, particularly that last episode. So, again, we cannot be held responsible if you listen to this and go, oh, you spoiled it for me. We are definitely going to spoil it.
Yeah.
We have left long enough that we think that everyone will have had a chance now to have caught up if they hadn't before or whatever. So, yeah. Okay, so I guess we should probably start by just general impression.
Yeah, let's start off, as you say, general impression, and we'll start with the last episode, just looking at that, and whether it tied enough threads up to be a satisfying conclusion, really.
Yeah. Well, I'm in two minds about it, and I actually think that having read the books has affected how I feel about the ending, because knowing the story from both the books and the series, a part of me goes, yeah, I can completely understand why all the characters ended up where they ended up. It makes sense to me. Some people have said, no, it doesn't make sense, it's out of character, but I'm, you know, looking at it, I say I can completely understand, particularly because, you know, the writers, they were told the ending. They were said, this is how, where all the pieces are going to go.
Yeah.
At least all the major pieces have ended up predominantly where George R. R. Martin intended them to go. Of course, he might change that now, having seen the reaction. But predominantly those main pieces will have ended up where they were expected to. And I think what's happened is that the writers knew where it was going, but kind of developed the characters in a slightly different way in the series, and then it felt a little bit strange. So on the one side, actually, I was quite satisfied with generally how things ended. It made sense in terms of the story, and it made sense in terms of Martin's writing style, whereby it wasn't the prophecies and things like that. It was about cause and effect. This happens, which causes this. It was more like a history than an epic. So on that's one side, I completely agree with that. On the other side, I wanted it to be an epic because the way that it had been done in the series was more like an epic. So I think everybody was hoping for a different ending. So yeah, that's how I feel about it.
Yeah. Generally, I agree with you there. I would say that it sort of made sense because I'm looking at it from the perspective of, yeah, the character arcs and the books are clearly leading in a direction that could put them here at the very mm-hmm. end. The series, on the other hand, though, obviously went off in its own direction. And it's not yeah. that where it ended was a problem for me. It's a case of they did not take enough time to get there. And this isn't me just being greedy and wanting, like, you know what, you could have done another series, another half series. That it's not greed. It's a case of you've done this fabulous character development that's uber detailed all the way through 7 series. And in the 8th series, you're going to go, yeah, I think we'll finish the whole thing in 6 hours. And I'm like, I don't think so. I really,
yeah.
really don't think so. So they didn't leave enough space. You could have sold me on any single one of those closures on the plot thread if you had given it enough space for the characters to go on that journey, but they just didn't. So
they didn't, yeah.
It made sense and it was kind of satisfying, but it was kind of the hollow satisfaction you get after you've been hungry and you eat a chocolate bar rather than a meal.
Yeah. No, I know exactly what you mean. And yeah, the series was too short. They should have had at least 2-3 more episodes, even if they wanted to keep it short. But I agree, they could have had significantly more episodes. But they could have also changed things a little bit in that, you know, the first 2 episodes there was quite a bit of stuff which was great in terms of fan service, but you didn't really necessarily need it.
Yeah.
And then suddenly everything was really rushed at the end. And I think something else we do have to consider, of course, about why it was rushed is that the series has taken out large chunks of things that happened in the books. I mean, there's a whole other Targaryen in
yeah.
the books running around,
plus,
right?
Plus Catelyn Stark is alive again in the books.
Yeah, Catelyn Stark is alive again,
so,
yeah.
You know, there's a whole bunch of people who didn't die in the books who... Yeah. Or didn't stay dead, at least, who weren't in the series.
Yeah, and I mean, there's a whole complete characters who were never even bloody introduced. You had one of the Dornish princes who got burned to death by one of the dragons, and anyway, so you have all of these characters who weren't included, who would have obviously contributed towards that end. But because they weren't included, because they weren't there, we don't know what effect they would have had. And so it might be that George R. R. Martin does finish it exactly the same way, but not the leading up to that will be very different because he will have had all these other story, lines, all these other plots, all these other characters who will have had an effect on things. And certainly I think that if there had been another Targaryen who was threatening Dany's rule, other than just Jon, I could kind of understand her being pushed a little bit towards where she ended up. But ultimately what happened was because this other Targaryen wasn't there, we didn't get that kind of slow development. Suddenly she snaps when Jon is also like, oh, hey, I'm also a Targaryen. It was just, hey, I'm a Targaryen.
It was out
that
of
being
left
said,
field.
A lot of people were really... It was out of left field. That said, everyone was just there like, oh, she overreacted with the whole Jon thing. I'm like, I don't know, if I just discovered that I was making out with my own nephew and that I'd fallen in love with him, I would probably also be a little bit perturbed, not particularly happy.
Yeah.
For a number of reasons.
We'll get to Daenerys, but that the incest wasn't the bit that was bothering her. That was more bothering Jon. So it would seem. Incest is kind of like, well, actually, you're kind of good enough for me now because you're a Targaryen. Anyway, we'll get to it.
Yeah.
That last episode, unfortunately, I think can we just take a moment to appreciate what a huge achievement Game of Thrones as a series is? Obviously.
Yeah.
Martin as a writer is like a pantser. He pantses all the way through, and there's nothing wrong with writing like that, but it does mean that you tend to write a bit slower, particularly if you're writing something as huge as A Song of Ice and Fire. But the series did well with everything they'd been given, and they did well to continue after that and followed the outlines of the character arcs quite well, I thought. But what really made it was this was a huge achievement because you had so many creatives from various different walks of life all pulling together to make this visually spectacular and in many other ways spectacular series of television. I mean, have you seen anybody discuss something quite as intently since, say, Harry Potter?
No.
And it's that level of sort of fandom and involvement and rage as well. But then you had fantastic actors who gave it their all. You had screenwriters who did the best they could with what they were given. You had costume designers, musicians, the people who actually did the filming. Some of those shots were just like artwork. So,
yeah.
As a piece of art, Game of Thrones, the series, is utterly fantastic. I'm not sure we've ever seen anything quite like it in those terms.
No. I mean, Game of Thrones changed television, I think, in a lot of way. It really, really, I know that we'd had, you know, other TV series up to that point, and fantastic TV series, but Game of Thrones is revolutionary because it's like The Lord of the Rings, except it's a series.
Yeah.
So much money has been poured into it. And you're right, the detail, the artwork, the acting, the music, it's just mind-blowing. Like, the CGI as well. Those were great dragons.
Yeah. I mean, there literally was no detail too small. Even when it's something it's going to be in a frame for like half a second, and you'd have to actually pause the film to watch it to see these tiny details in costume and positioning and things like that. And fans obviously have done this.
Yeah.
just, and the tiny little clues as things for the future and various other things. And it, you know, you have to admire that level of commitment to it. And yeah. Again, especially I think the actors who really brought everything to those characters. I don't think there was anybody there who was phoning it in ever.
No, absolutely not. And I also think that just, I just a huge hats off to all of those actors, because some of them have been there for 10 years. You know, they've grown up, they've lived, breathed Game of Thrones. They you know, there was a whole bunch of them who actually moved to Northern Ireland because they were doing so much filming there. You know,
yeah.
They raised their kids in Northern Ireland. They bought houses. I mean, it's just phenomenal. The stress they were under, you know, it's so I do think that a lot of people are complaining about Game of Thrones. And whilst I am really happy to kind of analyze it and say, what would I want? What didn't I like? I think it is really important to remember that this is something that so many people poured their life and soul into. And they don't really owe us anything.
No, they absolutely do. I mean, I found the whole idea of a petition to remake the 8th season utterly laughable, because in a way that's a very spoiled brat attitude, isn't it? That's, you didn't give me what I want, I demand a refund. But it's a refund of my time because I've committed this much time into it. And that is laughable because that's so petulant. And that's not considering that everybody who has given everything to make this great piece of artwork deserves a lot better than you to turn around snootily and say, well, I didn't like it, I'm signing a petition. It's ridiculous.
Yeah, it's rude, to be honest.
Yeah, it's very rude. Yeah, I do think overall the series had some flaws. There were things that definitely irritated me. But generally, it's kind of like those flaws for me make you see just how amazing it was, in a way.
Yeah, and I think the other thing that I kind of like about the ending is that even if you don't like where things ended, even if you say, oh, I wanted John to rule, you know, the Six Kingdoms, I wanted this to happen, I wanted the Starks to stay together, etc., 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 I wanted Dany to live, you can totally walk away from that and say, yep, Dany's coming back. Drogon, the dragon, took her off to in the direction where there's going to be a Red Priestess. The Red Priestess will bring her back. The winter isn't really over. Bran is actually the Night King. Jon is at the is now King of the Wildlings, really, because they bloody love him. You know, like, you can continue it on in your head and finish it in whatever way you want. The nice thing about Game of Thrones is even if someone is dead, they do not have to stay dead. It's actually quite reassuring.
Yeah, and you know, if it's not enough for you, there's between 3 and 5 planned spin-offs, and I think we can assume that at least 2 of those will get made. So I don't know if they'll ever recapture what they did with Game of Thrones, but I'd love to think it was possible and that it wasn't just a one-off thing.
Yeah, absolutely.
So that's where we are with the final episode. We will talk about the infamous Battle of Winterfell episode as well, but we'll do that in conjunction with Arya. Because I think that makes most sense. And we're just going to run through the characters and we're going to and look at their character journeys, because that's probably the best way of examining the entire series.
Yes.
So without further ado, we're going to start with Jon Snow.
Yes, let's start with Jon Snow. Now, I know some people are not particularly fond of Jon as a character, but he's always been one of my favourites.
I don't think there's a lot to dislike there, unless you're kind of being in a sense of, oh, come on, you need someone who's got a bit of cunning, or someone who's willing to bend the rules a little bit. And every so often, even I've thought, well, that's a little bit annoying. But the whole point of Jon is that he is Ned Stark's son through and through, even though he's not Ned Stark's son.
He's not Ned Stark's son, yeah.
He emulates the man who he looked up to as father. He emulates his older brother, Rob, who kind of fucked up by, you know, breaking the rules.
Being Ned Stark, yeah.
Yeah, and it's just a case of, this is somebody who is driven by his, you know, his conscience. He's driven by his moral compass more than anything else. He doesn't take very much time out for himself, for things that he wants. He has literally no ambition other than to just do a job well. which is rare. And he's not someone who's ever really wanted more than he's got. What he most wants is a small portion of personal significance and a certain amount of acceptance. He wants to be around people who accept him. And I think by the end, he has found people who accept him. They just happen to be the wildlings.
The thing that always really gets me, which is John has continuously, the entire time, you know, he was very insecure at the beginning because he realized very young that he was not going to inherit. He was never truly Ned Stark's son, that he was, you know, he was a bastard. And so he always felt and very out of place in Winterfell, and he wanted to go up, wanted to find his own place, his own people, his own purpose, and his own life, you know. And he gave up his title, but the thing is, he never had a title, and he never wanted one. And continuously, what has happened is John has been presented with more and more titles and responsibilities, despite desperately screaming, "No, I don't want it." There is even this great scene in the books that you don't really get in the series, where Stannis Baratheon says, "Join me, Lord of Winterfell," because all of the other, they believed all the other sons of Ned Stark were dead. He said, "I will make you Lord of Winterfell, but you must change religion and worship the fire god," or whatever, the Lord of Light.
Yeah.
And John actually really does think about it, because John wants to go back to Winterfell, and he thinks about being, you know, Lord of Winterfell. But ultimately he says no, because it would mean turning his back on his family's god. And it's odd because he looks at Ghost, who has the white fur and the red eyes, and that makes him think of the trees. And so he says no. And that's always been integral, because it's not actually the title which is a part of his identity. And actually, you know, he was able to really be Jon Snow when he was up on the wall, but then he becomes commander, and then, you know, and then he's king of the North, and then they're like, "Oh, now you're king of the Seven Kingdoms." He's just this guy who's continuously been like, "No, I just want to go to the wall. Please let me go to the wall."
Yeah.
And yeah, sure, he leaves after, you know, a moment where basically he's told all of his brothers have murdered him. He has a very low moment where he's gone, "I've done the best I bloody can. You put me in this position. I did what I thought I had to, and then you murdered me. So thanks." Despite being the only sensible person. And then it's actually, "I'm going to go south so that I can retake my home and protect my family and stop this giant war which is happening." But all he ever did want was to go to the wall and just be himself. And so actually, I'm kind of glad that Jon Snow, having literally been given the ultimate title, was happy to turn around and leave it behind and didn't want it. And also, for me, it was really symbolic of the fact that broken, because on the one side, it would have been absolutely epic. If it was an epic, John would have absolutely become that king, because he was the prophesized one. You know, he's the perfect candidate. But in terms of a realistic sense, would it have been any different? Because he was just another Targaryen. And yeah, he was a Stark as well, but he was another Targaryen. What gave the Targaryens the absolute right to rule? It's not like they were good kings. In fact, historically, shit kings quite recently. They were not great. So it wouldn't have actually changed anything. It would have just been, he wasn't the rightful ruler just because he had a Targaryen name. So I think it was actually kind of cool that they went, "No, we're not actually going to put Targaryen on the throne. We're going to elect our king sort of democratically."
Yeah. So just to round up on John, because we've got a lot to get through.
I'm sorry.
No, it's fine. He's got a really interesting character journey, but ultimately he is a study in subverting tropes. He is the boy who is born with a destiny and isn't aware of it and isn't treated very well, like, you know, Wart in the Once and Future King, and many, many other tropes as well. He's also the epitome of "some have greatness thrust upon them." Well, he does, but every time he has greatness thrust upon him, he pretty much does everything he can to get rid of it, including pissing off his Night Watch subordinates to the point where they pull the Caesar on him. So he's not wrong. He's not actually wrong at any step of the way. But by doing the right thing, he kind of makes so many difficulties for himself, which is the theme of Game of Thrones. The theme of Game of Thrones is you are answerable for the consequences that happen to you to a certain extent. Very few characters just have shit happen to them. They are victims of their own choices, even when they didn't know any better. The final thing is that he, reluctant hero side of things, it's a case of, well, I'll do it because it's right. And he's somebody who will actually one day completely break himself because he's giving everything up for this idea of what is right. And, you know, as we've said, he, even though he's not Ned Stark's son, he is Ned Stark's son in the way that he comports himself with the rest of the characters.
Yeah.
So let's move on to Daenerys Targaryen from there, because next big player.
next big player. Now, I'm not going to lie, I found her death to be really anticlimactic and kind of annoying. I would have really preferred if we'd had a whole episode where they went to battle and there was a kind of more of a fair fight than... Fight. The whole holding trope and then stabbing after you've kissed someone. Like, that's not...
That worked for me in the sense of she has a fucking dragon, so it's very difficult to get close to her unless she lets you.
Yeah.
So that worked for me in that respect. But there should have been, like, perhaps two or three episodes between the big I'm a fantasy Hitler speech and John stabbing her. Because there should have been... John wants his loyalty and faith is given, is incredibly loyal and faithful. So you have to really chip away at that. I know she'd just seen her burn King's Landing, but there should have been more. And there would have been John wrestling a lot with himself and her wrestling with the idea that he is a threat to her power, even though they both love each other. There needed to be more space. And to be honest, Daenerys needed perhaps another season of gradual descent into the Mad Dragon Queen. It was such a sudden change. There'd been hints of it, but it was too quick. And that
was the thing
problem.
It had this kind of this disinterest when she'd seen people burning alive. And you actually see that in season one, and people said, oh, you know, watching what happened to her brother didn't count. And that's not actually the incident that I think of when I think of her burning people in season one. And I think of her burning the healer woman. Who let her husband die.
Yeah, burned her alive in order to hatch the dragon eggs.
Yeah. And despite what was actually a great narrative, like when Tyrion says, everywhere she goes, she kills bad people. She kills bad people and we applaud her.
Yeah.
And I loved that line because I was like, that's exactly what it is. We're like, yeah, but there were bad people, so it's excusable. And then suddenly it's like, how do we...
Who decides who's bad?
Yeah, who decides who's bad? The fact of the matter is that she's been allowed to decide who's bad for as long as she can remember, and she's always been applauded for it. So I can completely understand the fact that that's kind of where that madness has gone, but I agree. There should have been more. It was a jump. It was like we missed a step.
I mean,
halfway
she's always,
along the way.
She's always been a conqueror. She's always tended to a little bit of megalomania. And when there's been no other choices to make, she will choose for herself. And she's had to do that. That's how she's survived. But the whole sort of, you know, she kills people and we applaud her for a thing. That's really important because the time I first had a real doubt about Daenerys was when she crucified all the masters of Quarth.
Yeah.
She just let's select 100 people at random and just crucify them as an example. And I'm like, whoa, hang on a second. I can see what you're going for here, and we live in a ruthless time here in Game of Thrones land. But come on, are we going to pretend that you're completely the good guy? You're more the good guy than these people, but you're not Lily White, are you? And there was, in some ways, I think it was quite clever how they had her being the conqueror and she was lauded. And they even kept quiet about the whole white saviour narrative there as well. And then it was utilised at the end when she was taught, you know, giving... Emilia Clarke was just amazing all the way through. But especially when she'd finally won, when Daenerys had finally won and she was giving a speech to her Dothraki and her Unsullied. And it was kind of like going back between Dothraki and Valyrian, and it was kind of, you're kind of like, yeah, this should be a triumphal speech, but we've just seen what you've done. And what you've just done is the fantasy equivalent of dropping a bomb on Hiroshima. That was literally what that reminded me of. And here you are lauding it and talking to your troops about bringing that peace, inverted commas, to all the other enslaved countries, including Winterfell? Excuse me?
Yeah.
And it really was a kind of, this is a fantasy Hitler moment.
Yeah. And the interesting thing, though, is that as viewers, our view of it was completely tainted by the fact that we saw what happened on the ground. Now, if it had all been from the sky, and we hadn't literally watched her murdering a whole bunch of people, the whole narrative could have been very different. It could have been framed entirely differently, where she wasn't seen as someone who had just murdered a whole bunch of people.
Yeah.
Because actually, things like that have happened before, and the way that it's been framed, you know, has differed. And it was just the first time that it was framed as her being someone who, you know, framed from the victim's point of view.
Well, we got the vulture's eye view rather than the eagle eye view, which is what you normally get with a big sweeping battle.
Yeah, exactly. But also, it just showed that we went from this narrative, which always looked at it from her point of view, because she was the hero, to suddenly looking at it from the outside point of view. And I can completely understand her narrative turning into that. And again, there's this duology where I, on the one side, I go, completely understand why they ended up going in that direction. And you know, the fact that, yeah, she was getting to a certain age where that madness was going to start presenting itself. And actually, you can see the beginnings of it. Again, I just think they missed a step because it suddenly went full-blown out of nowhere.
Yeah.
Rather than this gradual build-up, which they had been doing, and then it was no longer gradual. But then on the other side, I feel really for Emilia Clarke. You know, I've been hearing reports about sort of the actors, but, you know, Emilia Clarke, who had some terrible health difficulties when they started with Game of Thrones. She had two brain aneurysms, and then really struggled when she found out, you know, she'd used Daenerys as her strength, as her rock, and she loved playing Daenerys, and, you know, she put so much into this character. And then in the last season, without any real great preamble, having not even been told that this is where it was ending, you know, that was the direction for Daenerys, she must have been heartbroken. I just don't think it was fair that she hadn't been given the forewarning. And I think that if she had been given the forewarning, we might have had more of a chance to see that build-up of that madness.
Yeah, well, I mean, I don't know, because I think she signals it quite well through.
In the last season, yeah.
In the last season, but yeah,
before, in previous seasons.
Yeah, no, I don't think they were just Conqueror-type episodes where she does something a little bit, where we go, ooh, but we make excuses for the character. And you're right, there's almost like another season's worth of her descending into this megalomaniac. I have to admit, I hate the whole sort of all the Targaryen madness, as in it's kind of like a tragic predestination. So like a Greek play, ultimately you're going to end up where you started, and it doesn't matter if you took the scenic route to get there or not. And that bothers me a little bit.
Yeah.
Particularly because madness is such a loose term as well. And it's a case of, well, you're a victim of your own family and your own bloodline. You can't break it. Which John obviously demonstrably did by issuing all power.
Yeah, but I think it did help with John and the fact that, you know, he wasn't entirely interbred.
Well, yeah, okay. Admittedly, interbreeding for generations and generations are going to give you the sort of characters where, you know, the gods flip a coin every time one of you is born, as Varys put it.
Sorry, I just want to conclude with Dany. I don't actually think she was the Mad Queen. I don't think she, you know, had developed any form of kind of, you know, what we would consider to be madness. So I don't know what they would name it. Would it be schizophrenia or, you know, inability to arrange thoughts? I don't know what they would call it. But I don't think she was actually mad. I think that she had massive post-traumatic stress, she had a bit of a breakdown, and I you know, there was this a little bit of maybe narcissism coming into it and things like that, but I think that these were all circumstantial things, and if certain events hadn't transpired in certain ways, she would have been entirely stable.
Yeah, quite possibly. I mean, she had a lot of her support network knocked out. She'd basically lost two of her children in the wars. And I think she genuinely believed her own legend by the end as well, which is one of the most dangerous things a leader can ever do, is you start believing what everybody says about you to the point where you do think it is your destiny. You are predestined. You are the chosen one. You are the one who is going to bring an end to it. You're going to break the wheel. And that's what she was doing. That was that choice she made in the middle of the Bells episode before she started burning everything, which was a case of, I can't free this lot, but I can free all the children of the future, which is a horrible way of looking at things, but it makes a twisted kind of sense as well.
Yeah. Absolutely.
So, while we're on the subject of queens, let's talk about Cersei, who has become something of a gay icon. I keep seeing it in my feeds on Instagram and things, and I think it's great that so many people have sort of like, yeah, we know she's the bad guy, but we love the fact that she was kind of the main villain towards the end of the eighth season, and they love the actress and everything. I just think that's really cool.
I think it was the short hair as well.
That was the deciding factor. It was that in the case of, no, I'm going to wear fabulous dresses and do what the fuck I want and drink wine. And I'm like, okay, fine, I can see your point.
Well, I mean, that is Cersei's pretty much role in the entire last series was to stand at windows drinking wine. And now, don't get me wrong, the actress is fantastic. She's brilliant.
Yeah.
Again, all the actors are just, there wasn't a weak link, you know, among them. They were all fantastic. They were all great. Actress for Cersei, brilliant. Absolutely brilliant. So I'm not, she was just standing at windows. I'm not saying that was a terrible, bad performance. She aced it. And it's true that at the end, you do kind of feel sorry for her. And it's weird because, you know, since the beginning, there have been some very nasty characters who I've craved the moment they die. Like, I've really craved it. And the weird thing about Cersei is that whilst I've always wanted her to die as well, whilst I've always wanted her to get her comeuppance every time she does something terrible, I do always kind of feel a little bit sorry for her. And I did feel sorry for her at the end there.
Yeah, she was a product of... Well, she was a product of the world she lived and grew up in. She was clearly probably one of the most intelligent of the siblings, and she had the drawback of being born female for a start. But then she was also stunted by her inclination towards spite, and that really hobbled her.
It did, and I do think that if she and Tyrion, if she hadn't hated Tyrion so much, things might have been different.
Yeah.
Because I think between her and Tyrion, they could have actually formed a really strong alliance. You know, if the three siblings had been stronger together, they could have actually pushed against their father altogether. And pushed the things that he did to them and the way that he warped them and the situations that they ended up in. But she didn't. She was spiteful. She hated him. She blamed. She got a lot of her cues from her father, who blamed Tyrion for their mother's death, and also because that was the only mother. That was the only female figure she had. So she was raised in a household of men, and you know, watched them do all these things, and was then she had no role model for herself. She had no perspective of what her role was, except that, you know, she was just as good as even more intelligent than Jaime, and yet had no place at the table, really. And she kind of crawled her way up, and she was spiteful, and she was cruel as well. I think that's important to remember. She has quite cruel.
Yeah, well, she cared about no one except herself and her children, ultimately, and to an extent, Jamie. But again, that was quite mutable, depending on what day it was.
It was, yeah.
So, I mean, I think if your redeeming feature is that you love your children, you don't have many redeeming features, because that is the absolute baseline of what you should be as a mother, is that you should love your children.
Yeah, absolutely.
Okay, let's talk about Jamie. I've kind of got a problem with Jamie's arc, and I think, again, largely it is to do with the fact that there wasn't enough space, and it was such a sudden about face that you then ended up once again with Jamie back being the person he was at the very beginning, so his entire journey was kind of pointless.
Yeah, a lot of people really complained about that. Again, I wasn't actually surprised, but I agree, you missed that there was a step that was missed in him returning to that. And I think that with Jamie and his whole character is that ultimately he could never let go of Cersei. He really genuinely loved Cersei. And in the books, that was one of the things that actually made me forgive him, in that I just, you know, originally he's kind of put forward as this sort of deviant, you know, this really disgusting character. Until you understand that this is a man who just absolutely loved Cersei. He adores her. He can look at no one else. She has dominated him for, you know, their entire lives. He cannot let go of her. And he wasn't prepared to let her die despite everything. So I definitely understand it. But
there were like three episodes missing there.
Yeah.
There were three episodes where he's working things out. And because, yeah, okay, there was no one except Cersei, but he really did spark with Brienne as well. And I'm not saying I wanted Jaime with Brienne, because to be honest, she could do a hell of a lot better. And I would include Tormund in that, because at least Tormund would have been respectful. I am going to rant a bit about Brienne, because that's one of the characters I think got most hard done by. But yeah, the way they did it, the sudden about face in the series meant that a lot of his arc didn't mean anything. We needed a lot more, in my opinion, in storytelling terms, of him sort of, I've come this far and yet I can't stop looking back. And maybe you could have done that in about six different frames, possibly, but we didn't get them. So all we saw was him suddenly going, oh God, my evil sister, who I know is evil, is about to die.
My evil sister who I know is evil, who literally sent someone to assassinate me. Because the assassin literally told me. He still goes, yep, going back to Cersei.
It's just really frustrating. I am going to mention Brienne now, because it seems a good enough time. I think we're going to run over a bit today, by the way.
I think we are.
Anyway. This isn't me just being a case of, okay, well, there is one female warrior character, because there's other female warrior characters, but Brienne's interesting because she is the one female character, she's the one character as a warrior who actually embodies all the knightly ideals. So all these people are kind of like, oh, I'm Sir So-and-so, I'm Sir what's it, and, you know, I'm the Knight of Flowers and whatever, and they're all supposed to embody, you know, the code of chivalry, which is a bit of a crock, to be honest. She actually does, even though she's not a knight. It irritated me that Jamie kind of gave it to her a bit as a party favour. I think he meant it, but also at the same time it was kind of a, you know, we're all going to die, so we may as well do something. So that bugged me.
The thing about that, sorry, just that scene, is that I believe 100% thoroughly that Tyrion completely orchestrated it.
Yeah.
Because there's no way that he made that mistake in calling her Sir Brienne, you know, so like a Sir Brienne. Oh, wait, of course, you're not a knight. And he wasn't doing that to tease her. I think he was literally there like, get on with it, Jamie.
Yeah, quite possibly. The other things that bugged me... After the infamous battle of Winterfell, she ends up getting pulled into a drinking game. And actually, it's kind of nice seeing her lower her guard a little bit. Except, yeah, she gets pulled into a drinking game. And while it's nice seeing her lower her guard a little bit, that drinking game is then used to humiliate her. I hate the fact that it's used to humiliate her over something like virginity, which is just a construct, people. It's just a construct. Mm-hmm. It means what you think it means. It doesn't mean anything more than that. I won't get too rabid about it, but that was really annoying. It certainly wasn't something that needed to be fixed. It wasn't a case of, oh yes, I've neglected to lose my virginity, and Jamie going, oh, hold my beer, I'll sort this out. And I felt that the entire thing was incredibly manipulative, because obviously he did feel something for her, otherwise he wouldn't have been, probably wouldn't have been jealous anyway.
And yeah.
Then to have her completely break down when he left, now, in my more generous moments, I want to believe that she was weeping for him because she saw the best that he could be, and he was choosing not to be that, so she was crying for him. But the way it came across was, oh God, you took my virginity and now you're leaving me. And there's been all sorts of memes on Facebook about one night stand, guess how they spell night, and things like that. And I'm just like, it's so fucking tasteless. And the character, it doesn't fit. It just doesn't fit. And then to add insult to injury, at the very end of the last episode, you see her writing Jamie's history in the Book of Nights. And like, well, okay, great, but are you going to turn the page and write yours down, Brienne? Because you've had quite a life. Not least of which, people wouldn't fucking knight you, even though you were more of a knight than all the rest put together, because you happen to be born female. So the whole thing just fucked me off, because it just stank.
Yeah, I completely agree. But on the same note, I completely understand why she'd want to write Jamie's history. And again, it's more because of the books than the series. And in the books, it was because she hated him. She really, really hated him to begin with. She found him to be the complete antithesis of what she believed in terms of being a knight.
Yeah.
And actually, in the end, despite everything, he did uphold a lot more of those kinds of knightly virtues than a lot of other people. Knightly virtues which were completely disregarded because he was the Kingslayer, because no one was interested in his side of the story, and because he was a great scapegoat. And I think in that way she saw her a little bit, in terms of, you know, it's very easy to dismiss all of the good things he had done and his loyalty in the end, because he made a promise to go and help fight the dead, but ultimately he was still, you know, bequeathed, or he was still, you know, connected to Cersei, and he couldn't turn against her. Now, obviously that was because of love, but also
codependency. You know,
codependency. Absolutely. But I can completely understand why she wanted to write that. She wanted to correct it, because I think she understood him when nobody else did. And he will go down in history as being a villain.
Perhaps.
I
just don't think they balanced that very well in the series.
No, I agree. I don't think they did it that well in the series. And I'm glad that Brienne, you know, ends up in a powerful position. You know, she's part of the council, which I thought was very cool.
That was cool, but again, it felt kind of like throwing a bone. And also, it doesn't really explain why she is suddenly no longer in Sansa's service. Did she just release herself of the vow, or what? You know, again, didn't explain it.
No.
So,
unless she's the spokesperson for the North, I don't know, like an ambassador.
She was wearing the sigil of the Three-Eyed Raven, not of the North.
Man, I don't know.
So, it was just clumsy, and that didn't work for me. And also, it was kind of, you know, they'd started to recoup a little bit of ground on how they were treating women in the series, and then you do that, and it's kind of like, oh, fuck you, seriously. So that's how I felt about that one. let's talk about Tyrion, because he's had quite a journey too, and for some reason he became really stupid in the last season.
So Tyrion did become a bit dumb in the last series, and again, I think that that's largely due to the fact that they had large chunks of the story removed.
Yeah.
Because of course in the series he's working with Daenerys, whereas in the books he's actually currently in league with the other Targaryen prince.
Yeah.
Whose name is also Rhaegar? How many Rhaegars are there?
Quite a few.
Or maybe his name's Aegon. I don't know. I can't remember. Regardless. You thought that was the grandfather?
I was going to say, I thought that was John's name.
No, John is also called Rhaegar.
Oh, right. Okay. Yep. Yeah, fine. So just
Yeah,
to be
it's
confusing.
no, wait, no, Rha no, Rhaegar Targaryen is no, sorry. Oh my God, no, Rhaegar Targaryen is their father.
Yeah,
So
that's
John
right.
actually has a half brother. That's
Yeah.
it, because that's John's half brother.
Yeah.
So that's awkward. Anyway, so Tyrion's in league with him. So I can kind of understand, that there might have been some other things going on there. But yeah, in this series, Tyrion does do some stupid things, and I think in the end he kind of wants to believe the best of Cersei because he hasn't really seen her at her worst. He genuinely thinks, oh, she will do this because she is pregnant, she has something to lose, and then she doesn't.
Yeah, she wants to believe that he wants to believe the best of Daenerys as well. I think we're being
Yeah.
presented with a portrait of a man who is just so utterly weary of war and fighting over the Iron Throne that he would really, really like the whole matter settled properly and to just go on from there and start making a better land and better country, which is ultimately what does happen, but.
And the thing is, he makes a couple of mistakes in terms of he makes a mistake in terms of his assessment of Cersei. But from that point on, even though Sansa has kept not Sansa, even though D Dany has kept him as her advisor, she doesn't listen to anything he says. And everything kind of she still wins, obviously, as far as she's concerned, but. She doesn't win because she gets killed because she did some bad shit.
Yeah, I mean his journey in some ways has been similar to John's, and it's been a case of being an outsider within your own family and trying to find somewhere that you fit in. And ultimately, I think by the end, he has not ended up, he's sort of ended up where he began because he's Hand of the King, but he's also probably the person best qualified to be Hand of the King if you ignore the few bits of stupidity before that. In the sense of his interest really is in creating a better Westeros. Which is what he was doing when he was acting hand for Joffrey as well. He started making things better until someone else came in and started interfering.
And he's genuinely compassionate as well, but he's also learned from his hubris. He's learned from his mistakes. He's learned he's not always the cleverest person in the room, which has made a big difference. Can I just say as well, I know this is going to sound really stupid, but I think it's kind of cool that Westeros is basically being run by two people with disabilities.
Yeah, I'll talk about that more when we get fin when we finish with Bran, because that's where we're heading. We're ending with Bran, kind of like the series does.
But I do agree. I think he actually makes perfect sense as Hand of the King. And I also think the other reason he makes great sense as Hand of the King is that he's got a good relationship with Sansa
Yeah,
as
which
well.
makes it interesting. Let's talk about Sansa, who has been, without a doubt, one of my least favorite characters for the entire show. That's no reflection on Sophie Turner, who's done an excellent job of acting the character, but honestly, yeah, she starts off a naive, rather stupid girl who's selfish, self-involved, and makes some pretty epic mistakes. What really has bugged me is the way people were saying, "Oh, Sansa should be Queen of the Seven Kingdoms." And I genuinely am in a state of, "What fucking show are you watching?" Seriously, if your basis for having a good queen is the idea that somebody who has suffered and managed to survive, not even by using a lot of agency, but just managed to not die, then that's setting the bar really, really low. And yeah, okay, coming through a trauma, it has made her a wiser, stronger person, but she kept making the same mistakes. It's not like it happened once or twice and she was better, she learned from it. It was a case of, oh, six or seven of the same sort of mistakes before anything really sank in for her. And yeah, some of that is being a product of her upbringing, but it can't just be that. So, no, I would have said she was supremely unqualified to be Queen of the Seven Kingdoms. I can just about tolerate her being Lady of Winterfell.
See, I disagree. Well, no, I agree in some parts, but I think that with Sansa, she was robbed of agency in a lot of ways. She was robbed of choice. She was kind of pushed around. She had very, very little power, but she's very good. She learned very quickly from Cersei, really, actually. how to manipulate certain things so that she was in the best position she could be at any given moment. And despite efforts, she was stripped down. But in terms of leadership, she's actually been very practical. And I think that it's worth noting, you know, that when you had Dany and all her troops at Dragonstone, they never talk about how they fed them or anything like that. It was just very conveniently, clearly they had enough. Whereas when it came to them being at Winterfell, and obviously it was used to create this conflict between Dany and Sansa, which kind of annoyed me a little bit because I didn't think it was necessary. It would have been actually better if they'd gotten on, and then as Dany kind of went a bit downhill, Sansa went, hold on a second, I've seen this behaviour before, and took a step back. That would have actually been more powerful rather than just them immediately at each other's throats, because then it just felt like Sansa was being power hungry. But in terms of kind of leadership, she has been very practical. She has said, okay, no, we need to do this and we need to do that and they need to rest and we need to bring in food and we need to prepare for the winter. I can totally understand why she would actually be a great choice for to be queen of the North. But again, the problem with the series is the way that they framed it. It does just seem like she's there because she wants the power. And on the one side, yeah, I can understand someone who's been victimized their entire life wanting to be in a position where they can't be again and holding a position of power. But I think it fails to understand that Sansa isn't just in a position of power because she wants to be in a position of power. And she doesn't just make the decision that the North should not be part of the Seven Kingdoms just because she wants, again, to be in a position of power, but because she genuinely has looked at the circumstances and said, no, I need to do what is right for my people. And I think it is kind of poetic justice that this young girl who was desperate to escape the North, who was never really properly seen as a Northerner because she took so much after her mother rather than her father, has kind of grown up, who was the first one to lose their direwolf as well. The symbol of the Stark has now become the symbol of the North. I think that's kind of cool.
Yeah, again, this is one of those things where you could have sold me on it if it had been given a bit more space in the series.
Yeah.
But again, I do think she starts making slightly more intelligent decisions during the seventh season. I mean, there was one point where they were jerking us around and making us think that, oh God, Arya and Sansa were going to be at each other's throats, but they weren't. And that was really, really good. And then unfortunately, she sort of faded into the background. And I think the conflict with Dany could have been handled a lot better and given us a lot more, because it did look like pettiness, as in, I know I want to be the only powerful woman in the room, which is not what was going on at all.
Yeah. And again, part of that was that they wanted to show what was happening with Dany. But again, they wouldn't have needed to do that if they hadn't rushed that ending, which was totally unnecessary.
Yeah. But I will say that when Arya said, oh, she's the most intelligent person I've ever met, I was kind of like, no, you're not selling me on that. I do not believe that based on everything I've watched so far. You give me another three seasons of Sansa being intelligent and I might agree with some of that.
Well, that being said, the show is full of real serious dumbasses, which kind of annoyed me because John is loyal, but he's also been one of the more intelligent characters and one of the more compassionate characters as well, you know, in terms of...
He should never, ever lead an army into battle, ever. His strategy is shit.
He's not good at that. No, I can definitely... But in terms of, you know, being very sensible and like, hold on a second, let's bring the wildlings this side of the wall because otherwise they'll all die and then the army against us will be even bigger. And everyone's like, no, that's a terrible idea. We should just leave them to die. And he's like, you don't understand. We are fighting against the dead. We do not want to give them more dead. Now is not the time for personal prejudice, okay? Calm down.
But yeah, it's the classic zombie dilemma, isn't it? Okay, let's talk about Arya and the Battle of Winterfell, because that really kind of is where her arc closes, more or less.
Yeah.
Now, we didn't talk about it because I think we were worried about spoilers, but in the episode where we were talking about how people were complaining about how character arcs went, I think we might have gone, oh yeah, and there was that Game of Thrones episode and the whole Arya thing. We just didn't talk any further.
Yeah.
Because there were so many people, largely there were so many blokes clutching their pearls about how Arya got the kill on the Night King. And the thing was, that kind of just made the whole thing a little bit sweeter for me, I've got to say. Because I admit, up until it was just about to happen, I didn't see it coming. But of course it makes sense for it to have been her. She's literally just spent 10 years of her life learning to be a stealth assassin. So who else are you going to send?
Well, that's the thing. It's the bit that really amuses me about the whole thing, because everyone said, you know, she didn't have the skills to do that, you know, and I was just there like, what have you been watching? And also they're like, it should have been John, he had the skills. I'm like, what skills? What skills does John have?
John's battle strategy is to lift his sword and run single by himself, leaving his army behind into battle. And hope they'll catch up with him.
It's not that John is a bad fighter. John is a good hand-to-hand battleist, okay? He's a lord in that way, okay? He's someone who just will do a fair fight, and yeah, he might be a bit tricksy when you're kind of right in the middle of a sword fight, but he's not the greatest swordsman. And he's a shield and sword guy, okay? That was never going to work against the Night King. It literally wasn't. The Night King was way too powerful. And in the moment where it could have happened, the Night King just went whoop and just brought these other kind of like zombies to life, because Jon was not exactly subtle about coming towards him. You know, there was no way you could fight him head on head. That's why it had to be Arya. She was the only one who could slip through the shadows. She was literally the only one who could get under his guard.
Yeah, and what I think what I most like about her is she's gone on a hell of a character journey, but her character has remained consistent throughout, in the sense of she's always stayed true to her own personal ideal. Her personal ideal might be along the lines of, no, I don't agree with that, so I'm going to kill you. But I can respect that. I really can. It's like, I don't fit into this system, therefore I am going to find a way of existing outside of it. I mean, I've seen a write-up where somebody said, well, you know, Arya literally runs away from death all the way through. And I'm like, actually, no, I don't think she does. What I think she does is she thinks, I can't survive on this occasion, so I'll go back and I'll come back stronger. And she does it every single time. She's like a one-woman Roman army in that respect.
She is. But it's great, because I do like the fact that it call back to what do we say to the god of death, and that's literally what he is.
Yeah.
Not today.
So yeah, we were well prepared for that. She didn't lose her direwolf, she sent it away because it was safer. She's always made the strategic decision all the way through, even when that included getting beaten senseless in order to gain a skill. So, yeah, she's been on one hell of a journey. I don't agree with the people who are saying, oh, she should have been Queen of the Seven Kingdoms, because that's ridiculous. She's clearly not got any statesman craft. She doesn't want to be the lady of a great house. She's an adventurer. She's a wild child. I would have quite liked to have seen her assassinating more people, I've got to be honest, using the whole faceless man thing. But perhaps there will be a spin-off for her, and we'll get to see it then, in which case I can't wait. I'm just down for watching Arya kill shit. But she also had one of the healthiest arcs when it came to this. I rolled my eyes when she started checking Gendry out. I did. I'm like, oh, come on. Not everybody has to be paired up. But they did it really well. She decided to sleep with him under her own terms. And then when he basically offered her the moon and the sun, she said, thank you, but no thanks, because that's really not me. She didn't compromise on who she was. So in that respect, she was one of the best female characters in the entire thing.
And I think the other thing is, if he turned around and said, I want to just come with you, she wanted to, you know, she was happy for them to be family. And it's echoed in that other, you know, line before, you know, where they said, we can be family. Yeah. And he said, well, we wouldn't be, you'd be my lady. And the whole point about her is that that's never, it's not who she is. And even though she did lose her, it's quite interesting in terms of the way that they've lost their direwolves. She's a Stark, but she didn't follow the Stark principles. And in fact, the only person who kept their direwolf was Jon, who was a Stark through and through, despite being a Targaryen.
Yeah, it's interesting. So yeah, it was all very, very symbolic in that respect. I could go on and on about Arya, but actually, in some respects, her character arc is one of the least complicated. It's a very satisfying arc, both in the books and in the series, but it doesn't have some of the twists and turns of the others. And her arc, weirdly, is kind of parallel to Bran's, which we'll get to at the end.
Mm-hmm.
In the sense of her being where she needs to be and acquiring the skills she needs to acquire. Basically, I've got a lot of time for a character that starts off weak and acquires what they need to succeed. And, you know, beauty is displayed through competence and intelligence rather than just be looking right in the right sort of dress.
Yeah. Absolutely.
I do want to talk very briefly about Lyanna Mormont.
Yep.
Who is a great character.
Fantastic character, great actress, very traumatic death.
It was, and it's kind of like, that's pretty much the end of the Mormont line now, because she was the youngest surviving heir. Otherwise, you know, you wouldn't have had a 12-year-old girl sort of inheriting, or however old she was supposed to be. Was it 10? 10, 11, 12, something like that?
She was, yeah.
She was very, very young. And
yeah,
with Ser Jorah now dead as well. And she took out the giant. And it's kind of like, okay, that's kind of a good death, but it's also horrible. That's kind of the end of that house. And she kept the North together. She kept the North together when grown men who were experienced and seasoned warriors were going, oh, I don't think we want to get involved in this.
Yeah. They just didn't want a lashing from Lyanna Mormont, who was a true Northerner. She was brilliant. And I'm sad she died, but if she was going to die, it would be taking out a giant.
Yeah, it was the right way to go. I mean, I would love to see more of her. Has she even arrived in the books yet?
No,
I don't think so. So I hope she gets a bit more screen time there, because I'd just love to see more.
Yeah.
Because that was good. Varys, who was one of my favourites. Mostly because we all know that I like the tricksy, I'm not really on anybody's side, I follow my own motives type dubious moral characters.
Yeah, no, I have noticed that. Varys, his death was a little bit unsatisfying for me.
It really was. And again, when did he suddenly become stupid? He's been this great player of games who survived three monarchs so far.
Yeah.
And survived Cersei's rule, and he's always managed to get himself out of Dodge in time. And his focus has always been on representing the small folk who can't represent themselves. On trying to bring the best ruler available at the time to the Iron Throne. And then suddenly he just starts being an idiot. Like, what?
Yeah, and I didn't like the fact that Tyrion was the one who betrayed him.
No, it feels like there's a big chunk of story there that didn't get told.
Yeah.
In that respect. And again, no slur on the actors or anyone, because they all just did a brilliant job. I can't say that enough. But
yeah,
that was unsatisfying. I mean, you can see that kind of being the tipping point for Tyrion going, oh my god, I didn't think she would do that. And him suddenly thinking, no, this is how she treats people. Without trial, she will execute by fire somebody that she believes to be in any way treasonous. And being treasonous is a case of you disagree with the queen. Or you have the temerity to suggest that somebody else might be a better choice.
Yeah. Yeah.
But yeah, I loved him as a character. I thought he was great. His backstory as it unwound was really interesting and satisfying as well.
Yeah. No, I do, and I wish something more had come of it. Like, he'd pulled something before he died. Because you see him, you know, preparing stuff like that. And I was hoping, you know, that those would be letters to certain people.
Yeah, me too. And that was a very definite sort of the rings and the letters and everything being done. And then he goes off and we just hear nothing more of it. It's like, what?
Yeah. And which for me, it would have actually been kind of satisfying if he had sent out all those letters. He was executed. Daenerys took the throne, having destroyed King's Landing. And then a lot of other people arrived saying, hold on a fucking second, you can't do that.
Yeah.
And we're here to support the true king. And Jon being like, now hold on a second, I don't want to be king. But I actually kind of see the situation here and say, the people are not happy with you, Danny. And even though, you know, I did support you, I think you're going a little bit crazy. That would have actually been a little bit more satisfying. But it just kind of went a bit sort of, Varys is trying something, he gets caught, he dies, nothing comes of it. And it was a little, eh.
Yeah. It just didn't quite slot into place, did it?
No.
I found that I was borderline feeling that about Missandei's death as well, because I liked her as a character. I know in the book she's like 10 or 11, so it's almost a completely different character. And the affair with Grey Worm, obviously, presumably doesn't happen in the books. Yeah, on one hand, I can see capturing her and killing her as a way to destabilise Daenerys was a strategic move. And, you know, Daenerys was never going to sort of give up everything in order to get her back, but it was going to be a real loss.
Yeah.
But at the same time, it's a case of, did we have to kill her?
No, and the trend of kill the woman, in this case to hurt the other woman, but the problem was that this was kill the only real female...
Black character?
Woman, you know, black character, yeah, the only real woman of colour, and we'll kill her to destabilise and to excuse the sudden jump in Dany's character.
And again,
completely
brilliantly acted. That was an incredibly tense scene. And the way her last word was Dracarys was just like, I got chills, seriously. But
yeah, that was a beautiful performance.
I wish it hadn't happened like that.
Yeah.
Or I wish there'd been more. Yep. And there obviously.
Yeah, hats off to the actress.
Yeah, as a strategic move, it destabilises Daenerys, it destabilises Grey Worm, who is the commander of Daenerys' forces, because he just loses his shit, quite understandably, at that point. He's sort of clawed back some identity from having been enslaved and mutilated, to the point where the burning of King's Landing seemed to make perfect sense to him. And I can sympathise with him going all stabby, stabby, stabby after they'd surrendered. Way more than... Because at that point, there was nothing for him except to just kill as many of them as possible and perhaps hope that one of them took him out as well.
Yeah, but I think also, you know, it comes to the fact that he hates these people. He genuinely hates these people. They hate him. He hates these people. And now these people have taken away the woman he loved, the woman he wanted to leave with, you know?
Yeah.
And I tell you what, when she cried Dracarys, I got shivers as well. But in my head, all I could hear was the Mad King going, burn them all, burn them all.
Yeah. But, I mean, it was almost... It was kind of foreshadowed when they were all down in the crypt during the Battle of Winterfell, and she stands up for Daenerys when Sansa says, you know, your loyalties would be torn to Tyrion. And I'm thinking, okay, I can understand why you completely bought into Daenerys's legend. I really can. You're not right, but I can understand why you and Grey Worm and a bunch of others are, but it's a problem in and of itself kind of thing. And that was interesting, and I kind of wish that had been given more time.
And I do wonder if she'd lived and she'd seen what Daenerys had done from the ground, what would she have done? How would she have felt?
Yeah, it's interesting. She might have come, she might have just gone, you know what, I've thrown my lot in behind this person. That's it, whatever she thinks is good, because that's kind of where they were leaning.
Yeah.
Or it might have been a complete sort of cold water treatment. It's like, oh, that's not okay. But then would Daenerys have actually burned King's Landing like that if she hadn't have died?
No.
So that's... Right. Can we talk about Sandor and Gregor Clegane?
Yes. Now, that was a long time coming.
A lot of people
were really upset that Clegane died by fire.
It was... it sort of fit, and the sort of him taking his brother into it kind of worked. I didn't want him to die at all. I know basically the Hound is not a great guy. He's a bit of a brute. He was a child murderer. That's how we get introduced to him in the first place. And then as you unfold more of his story and you see some of his interactions with Sansa, from the fact that he tries to protect her and Arya, you realise actually there is a decent person under all that. It's just his life has inclined him towards brutality. And I got really fond of him as a character. I just didn't want him to die. I would have liked him, you know, one-eyed to walk out of that, having finally killed his brother and found some measure of peace.
Yeah, I would have liked that as well. But I think the important thing there, and again, it was this kind of rushed thing where, you know, you have Arya, who's all about the revenge, and then one conversation with Clegane makes her go, yeah, you're right, and she just leaves.
Yeah, that made no sense.
It would have been better if we'd had more development of her going, actually, this is not the way of life that I want.
I can still get off this ride.
I don't need to do this. Yeah, I can still get off this ride. Whereas the whole point with, you know, I felt it was significant for him to turn around and say, stop it, because he knew he was going to die. And he said, I'm not coming out of this. But it was his entire identity. It was the only thing he had left. He couldn't enjoy anything else. He had nothing left to do. He wanted to protect Sansa. Sansa was now okay. He wanted to protect Arya. Arya was now okay. There was nothing left for him to do except now finish off his brother before anyone else did, because it had to be him, because that was his whole life. So I think it was poetic justice in the fact that he knew how it was going to end, and it did end in fire, which is where it started.
It's again that tragical thing, the tragical storyline whereby you end up where you started, and it started with fire, yeah. And therefore it ended in fire. Again, it suffered from lack of space, but the actors did brilliantly. You could really see that the Mountain, despite being zombie servant now, sort of broke his conditioning, because he hated his brother enough, and there was something weirdly satisfying about that. This wasn't a case of, I'm going to kill someone who doesn't even recognise me. It's a case of, I'm going to kill somebody who really fucking hates me. That kind of worked for me. Also, I did really like him backhanding the Maester into next week.
Yeah, that was... why?
Because I hated that oily, obsequious little man.
Yeah. That being said, I was surprised that he stayed. I thought he was just going to flee. But he stayed right till the end with Cersei. That surprised me. He was loyal, at least.
Or he had no purpose, and it was literally Sandor turning up that broke the conditioning.
No. Sorry, not the Mountain. I meant the oily...
Oh, right. Well, I don't suppose he had anywhere else to go.
He could have escaped. He's been oily enough. He could have escaped. I think
my attention with him went to, I'm just glad that character's dead. Obviously, brilliantly acted, but glad that character's dead.
Yeah.
Don't care. Ser Jorah, we should talk about poor friend-zoned Ser Jorah.
Yeah, so... my god, his last line, though. I'm hurt. It's like, yes, you are, Jorah. Please rest.
I think
But the fact that he stayed standing...
I was talking about this with Matt and Shell, and I think Matt summed it up best as in a case of, yeah, Ser Jorah's basically been waiting to die heroically for his queen since season two. And I'm like, yeah, actually, you're kind of there. I didn't get Daenerys's breast beating about the whole sort of, he loved me in a way I couldn't love him back. And I'm like, you didn't fucking care about that when you banished him. And yeah, there were reasons he'd betrayed you. There were various other things that, you know, in the days when you had more temperate reactions to friends betraying you and you banished them, didn't burn them alive. And he came back. And I get that he was like the one constant connection to who she used to be before this journey started. But
yeah,
he was the first person who really had faith in her. He was the first person who stopped seeing her as a pawn and started seeing her as a major player as well. So there was a lot of history there, but I also didn't quite understand the excesses of grief on that one, and that felt a little bit like, no, we must have people crying. It was kind of like Sansa crying for Theon Greyjoy, and it's kind of like, really? You know, I know he was kind of your brother, but then after everything he did, not sure about that.
Well, no, I can understand Theon in that Sansa doesn't really know about the other... Well, I mean, she knows about it, but he was also the one who saved her. And anyway, we're not talking about Theon. With Dany, I think a big part of what kind of drove her was a lack of love. She wanted to be loved, and Jorah was one of the first people to love her. And he was one of the last few people that she had who really loved her. Not just to the point that he loved her, he literally would have done anything for her, and he continuously did do pretty anything for her. That was the kind of devotion she wanted, and she lost it because she lost all the people who were that devoted to her one by one. And Jorah was the one who loved her unconditionally, not because she saved him, but because he just had loved her and he'd followed her. And he was a very close friend to her. And I think that she feels this regret, particularly about not being able to love him back. But I think she talks about that with John because of the conundrum that she has with John. And she's trying to prompt him because she loves John. So they say. They're all about, we love each other. And I'm like, again, we didn't really get to see much development of them liking each other to them really loving each other. They suddenly just seem to have this great love for each other, which we're told about, but we never really got to see. And I think that's what that was about. It was about sort of saying, I couldn't love him, but I love you. You can love me too.
I just think that could have been handled differently, and I think I would have handled it differently if it had been me. But that's personal preference. The actual character of Ser Jorah's, I've always found his character arc really interesting, and I think Dany did actually save him in a way because he was somebody who had lost his honour entirely by selling slaves, and she gave him a new purpose and something to serve, and he became part of this great, huge caravan of people who were moving across and changing the world, and that involved freeing slaves. And so he was seeing his redemption there as well. Yeah, he completely fell in love with her, and it was hopeless and unrequited, and was never going to be requited. But somehow that service, that purpose, and in the end, being able to die for her was enough.
Yeah, absolutely. No, and the actor was brilliant as well. I think it must be said. I think I'm just going to say that about all the actors, to be honest.
Yeah,
But
there wasn't a weak link. You were all excellent.
yeah. Well, I've heard, and I don't know how much credence there is to this, that they had considered not killing Jorah and sending him up to the wall instead. Which actually would have been interesting as well, because he would have been sort of that would about been about his relationship with his father and redeeming himself in his father's eyes, and taking up a position on the wall, which I think it would have been interesting if Ser Jorah had been on the wall and had just seen what Dany had done and how he would be coping with that as well.
Again, I think that's one of those things. If he's another prop and a support that had been knocked out, and if he hadn't gone, she might not have gone in that direction. So, I mean, it's difficult to say, but I think that's another one where if you'd had him and Tyrion and Varys and Missandei and
Melisandre,
everybody, and you hadn't lost another dragon through a seemingly arbitrary arrow thing. So, yeah, which they do like to do. They like to do that to shock us. Shell, is there anyone else you really want to bring up, or shall we move on to Bran now?
Well, I just want to talk about Bronn very quickly.
Yeah, interesting.
Who had almost nothing to do in the series, and it's because George R. R. Martin doesn't actually really like Bronn very much, but
Oh,
he's
I
a
didn't know
fan
that.
favourite. Yeah,
Oh,
apparently
yeah.
he's not very fond of him.
Oh, no, I mean, I like him as a character, but he's clearly not a good guy.
He's not a good guy.
That's kind of encapsulated in his speech about, yeah, if you're a big enough bastard, they make you king,
He's not wrong as well, but the thing is, like, Bronn had kind of been a little bit cooler, in the previous series, and I kind of wanted a little bit more from him here. And he was just sort of there, and then and I'm glad he survived because Bronn is the kind of character to survive. But one thing we really missed out on, which we get in the books that we don't get in the series, is the fact that Bronn is very isn't actually in the series that often. When in fact we don't really see him, we just kind of hear about him through Cersei, who really hates him, And of course, he's been married to this girl who was raped, and she's given birth to a son. And they call, and Bronn calls that bastard Tyrion.
Oh.
Which I think is, yeah, he calls the bastard Tyrion. This is after Tyrion has sort of run away, having killed Tywin. So Cersei's already kind of pissed off, because Bronn is obviously giving a giant fuck you to her, despite the fact that she's kind of, he's got a castle and a wife and stuff like that. And then what happens is she tries to convince Bronn's father-in-law to murder Bronn. But Bronn's father-in-law isn't particularly bright, so instead of just having him killed, which is what Cersei wants, he challenges Bronn to a joust.
Thinking
Bronn is lowborn and therefore is not knightly and therefore he will not be able to do this. And of course Bronn wins. At which point Bronn forces both the husband and the wife out of the castle, takes it over with his own wife now, with all of the men, and is just hauled up there gathering an army. And that's where we last saw him. And I think we were robbed of that. Robbed of Bronn just protecting his own and just seeing like, yeah, I'm going to call my bastard son Tyrion. And now I'm going to amass an army and I'm going to sit in my castle and no one's coming in.
Yeah.
We were robbed of that.
There should have been more for him to do. There should have been more for Yara Greyjoy to do because she was a great character. There was enough, just about enough Tormund, but, and obviously him and Jon riding off into the sunset together was just beautiful.
To get married together is beautiful, yeah.
Yeah, because, which was weird, because they'd always had this close friendship, but it wasn't until that moment I was kind of like, okay, do they realise what they're signalling here? Because that's coming across. And I know there's the whole brother-in-arms thing, but...
Yeah, well, no, because in the books it feels more like he's more like a father figure in some ways.
Yeah.
I mean, they're friends, but he's like an uncle figure as well. Yeah. So, yeah, Tormund was great. And I like the fact that Tormund really liked Brienne, but kind of got over it.
It's kind of like, oh, she chose somebody else. And then he moves away, respectfully. He doesn't just fuck her over. So, yeah, Tormund would have been the better choice in that respect.
Yeah.
Brief mention of Podrick as well. Master Coxman Podrick, who prostitutes pay to sleep with them, which is actually really quite funny, to be honest.
It is, except, oh, I cannot believe this. The actor who plays Podrick has been sexually assaulted by so many older women because of that.
No way, really?
Yeah, they've just sort of they just grope him and grab him. And it's like, there's so many Game of Thrones actors who've been, you know, like, who've been abused or bullied or harassed because of their characters. And like, guys, if you cannot
separate fantasy from reality here.
Yeah, from the actor, please go to therapy, okay? You cannot treat people like that. But he's got a great set of pipes on him, though. I tell you what, when he was singing, what is it, Jenny Oldstone or something?
Jenny of
Oldstone. I was like, whoa! That was very nice. So
yeah,
good for him. I'm glad he's there and he's serving Brienne. That's great stuff. Good stuff.
Yes. Okay, right, Bran, because we should wrap this up, really.
Yeah. Now, Bran kind of came out of nowhere, but I actually kind of agree. Yeah, okay, that makes a good king. There was that one thing, though, which is when Tyrion was giving that whole speech.
Yeah.
And there was just that line, which was... we were actually talking about this with some other friends, Jules and I, and Amelia... Our friend put it really, really well, where she said that whole line where he says, and stories, what's more important than stories and the tellers of stories and so forth? And she went, that's very masturbatory. Even for a bunch of writers, we were all going, ooh, okay, you bent over and you're really licking yourself now. That was...
Yeah, we were saying that.
And it's just embarrassing, to be honest.
It's the next line after that. And who has a better story than Bran the Broken? And first of all, hate that. Absolutely hate Bran the Broken. But moving on.
Mm.
Well, probably every single person there, almost, apart from Uncle Tully, or whatever he's called. Because...
Yeah.
Okay, I don't like Sansa, but she's got a pretty interesting story. Then there's Arya, I spent 10 years training to be a faceless assassin. Pretty good story. There's Tyrion, pretty good story again. And a lot of the others as well. So Bran has the best story because, I mean, where is this coming from? It just doesn't make sense. And the thing is, Bran has probably been masterminding this since he became the Three-Eyed Raven. Ever since you had the whole Hodor incident, where you realise where Hodor came from, there's a case of, there's a very good chance that Bran is losing himself as an individual and becoming literally the personification of history and is carefully putting people into place in order to ensure this outcome. It certainly was a masterminded thing with the Battle of Winterfell, getting out Arya in the right place. He's been watching everybody to check everybody is doing the bits they want to do and ending up where they are. Where it's unsatisfying is, it feels like a bit circle jerky, to be honest, in the sense that this is like history turning around saying, I'm fed up of all your wars, I'm going to stop it. And like the muse of history just steps in and says, I'm going to rule everything now and everybody will do what I say. Free will is an illusion. There is no such thing. And that kind of doesn't really sit very well in storytelling terms either.
Yeah, no, and the thing that got me is that I can turn around and say, actually, great, Bran is there, because Bran doesn't feel anything. That means he's never going to do anything out of spite, but that also means that Bran has just happily just stepped back and let people die. He doesn't care about anything because he's not meant to care about anything.
Yeah.
He's just the bookkeeper, which means, you know, he's there, king, he's just kind of going to let things go along. And again, one thing I liked is that he comes and he says, I see we're missing a spy master and a master of secrets and a, you know, basically the people, it was Littlefinger and Varys. He says, we're missing them. And he smiles. And people have joked about it saying, dude, you see everything. Why the hell would you need a master of secrets? As I'm concerned, that's him smiling because he knows who's going to fill that role.
Yeah,
and I can just actually see Arya Stark being a great master of secrets, but not from the table, if that makes sense. But also, you know, it's this whole sense of actually, I think Bran is there, but he doesn't expect to stay, which I can put in my own mind. I can enjoy that and just think there's going on from there. But yeah, he'll be a good king, but
he'll be a good king
because
there's no
he doesn't care about it.
Yeah,
there is no person there.
And wouldn't
but then what
empathy and, you know, a certain I want to do something be an advantage in a king? Anyway, I don't know.
Yeah.
It works and it kind of doesn't work at the same time for me, I think, is what it comes down to. And I liked Bran's story, certainly initially. I found it interesting. I really, really... There are things in that last scene, for example, Sansa saying Bran can't have children. And okay, yes, they put that in there just as a way of establishing that they weren't going to have, you know, a lineage of kings anymore. It was going to be elected kings like the Saxons used to do. But
yeah,
that's simply not true. You can be paraplegic and still father children or still give birth to children. It doesn't make any difference. It's a completely different set of nerve endings. So that fucked me off. And then there was the whole sort of constant repetitions of Bran the Broken. It's like, seriously, you couldn't think of a better title than that?
Yeah. At the same time, I understand where it's coming from in terms of the story. It did annoy me a little bit because they could have just said Bran the Three-Eyed Raven, or, you know, they could have called him the Three-Eyed Raven or something else. The whole thing with Bran the Broken is that it's the whole thing with Tyrion, where he always says, wear what you are, like armor, and no one can ever use it against you. So I can kind of understand that there and why they might have chosen it. And to say that despite the fact that, yeah, he is Bran the Broken, he's the king as well.
And it was obviously nice to see somebody in a wheelchair get to be king and not magically get reassembled, as it were, or healed or whatever.
Yeah.
It's, you know, your disability doesn't actually define you. I winced because it just didn't ring quite right.
Yeah, no, I completely agree. And I think in terms of a title, yeah, they could have... It could have been one of his titles, but I don't know. I did wince as well. But I can understand it, but I still winced.
Yeah, it just, that fell a bit flat. And again, the whole thing with Bran being king, a lot of people were outraged. I can see it, but I wasn't given enough space to really be sold on it, and that's what it comes down to for me. So give me the space, and I will probably believe that. Same with pretty much every other story arc. So yeah, I think that is my big criticism of the last season, is the fact that it probably needed to be twice as long as it was.
Yeah, definitely. Absolutely. But that being said, again, just to conclude, Game of Thrones has been a marathon, and it's been amazing. And I just take my hats off to every single person who was a part of that gargantuan process, because your efforts, despite what people have said, you know, like going on and on about the coffee cup and stuff like that.
Oh, for goodness
just
sake.
Like, calm down, guys. You know, despite everything that people have said, I just think it's been incredible.
Yeah,
so,
totally.
You guys.
I completely agree. And yeah, we all have our don't touch fandoms where we don't like people messing around with things because it doesn't fit with our headcanon. But can we aim for a normal level of perspective with these things? And the actors should not be getting death threats. George R. Martin shouldn't be getting death threats, to write it another way. The screenwriters, the directors who produced it, should not be getting abuse online because you didn't like the way it went. So it's just a story, ultimately. If you want, in your head, it can finish with the Battle of Winterfell, or it cannot have finished at all.
Or you can just do what I'm doing and just imagine that Daenerys flies back on her dragon. Jon has to come down from the north again.
Yeah.
And that the whole story continues.
And I will admit, I am interested to see any prequels or spin-offs from that as well, because they left themselves a lot of places to go.
And on that note, guys, we'll say thanks very much for listening. But before we go, it is time for our Dissecting Dragons recommendation. Sorry, I forgot it just for a second there.
It's time for
our recommendation.
I have one this week, and it is One Word Kill by Mark Lawrence. Mark Lawrence is best known for his dark fantasy and grimdark and, you know, borderline sci-fi stuff. But this is completely different. One Word Kill is time travel sci-fi. And it's set in the 80s, and it features a 15-year-old protagonist, Nick Hayes, who discovers he's got basically terminal leukemia. His chances of surviving are very, very poor. He and his friends are a bunch of D&D playing nerds, which is just done so beautifully in the book. It's wonderful. And it's kind of a coming-of-age story at the same time. So there's Nick having to face the fact that he might well die very young, and the fact that he really, really likes this goth girl who's joined their D&D group. So there's that level of it. And then this weird bloke keeps appearing in places and strange things keep happening. And Nick finds himself drawn into this epic adventure whereby he has to do things in the present in order to preserve the future. And it's so well played. There's lovely references to the 80s and 90s and things in there. And it's just, I can't recommend the book enough. And the second book came out quite recently as well. They were both produced within about a month of each other. And I got an arc of the second book, and Limited Wish, the second book, continues it. And it is just excellent. The third book is out in November. So if you're someone who hates waiting long periods of time between books, this is a great series to get into because all the books are out this year.
Okay, that sounds really interesting.
It's really, really good. And the audiobook's very good as well.
Brilliant. Okay. Well, on that note, guys, we'll say thanks very much for listening, and we'll catch you guys next week.
Yeah, thanks and goodbye.
Bye.
You've been listening to Dissecting Dragons, the speculative fiction podcast. You can follow our podcast at podbean.com, or from iTunes. For more information, visit our Facebook page at www.facebook.com/dissectingreaders, or check out our author websites at jaironside.com and madelinevaughan.com. Please note that no dragons were harmed during the making of this podcast.